Whatever the adventure, there's a BMW engineered to take it on. The X3 delivers a striking design with agile performance. The 100% electric i4, packed with pure electric energy. Or the plug-in hybrid X5, an impressive, versatile SUV granting full control on every journey. Choose what powers your next adventure during the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
Hey, y'all, it's Chip Patterson from the Cover 3 Podcast, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network. College football is about to enter its first ever 12-team playoff era, so join me, along with Tom Fornelli, Danny Cannell, and Bud Elliott, as we drop new episodes 5 times a week to close out the year. We've got reactions, bracket breakdowns, and best bets for these matchups with championship stakes. Follow and listen to the Cover 3 Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
And then Friday, warm in the 65, back to the 70s by Saturday and Sunday. Some more seasonal than cold. Mike Dettelier joins us now. We all know who Mike is. Morning, Mike. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you, Tom.
Well, I tell you one thing. I'm happy about the game didn't go into overtime yesterday.
So was I.
Man. That was, and I said this early, earlier, thank goodness that it was one of those games that really no team, it was a shame that anybody had to win, don't you think?
Well, somebody got to win.
Yeah, I know.
And
well,
so in that case, I'm glad it's the Saints that did. But this is what happens when you let sort of a bad team hang around. Because
yep.
Saints had chances just to put them away. And didn't do it. And, you know, they hang around. All of a sudden, they make a few plays. And they right back in the game. And they had a chance to tie it and bring it into overtime. The one guy who had one hell of a game was Brian Brisset.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen flashes of it before with Brian. But yesterday, he had a really strong game. Rushing the quarterback, two pass deflections, and then certainly the blocked field goal at the end of the game.
And look, you know, I heard some people, you know, Howard Cosell wannabe saying Derek Carr should have done this, shouldn't have done that. You play to win the game, all right? That's in the heat of the moment, you don't have a second to decide, should we do this? Second down, is it third down? Is it this? Is it that? Is it the other thing? And I think those same people, if he had not done that, would have been saying, what a wuss, he's going out of bounds. So you can't have it both ways, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the life of a quarterback, unless you're a star in this league. And even when you're a star quarterback, you get that criticism, too. So, you know, Derek understands this. When Jake DeLome told me this years ago. He's like, I forget which high school coach told him this, and he said, it's always stuck in my mind. He said, the day you decide you're going to be a quarterback, you better understand what that position means. You're going to get a lot of heat for playing. Everybody's going to be critical of you. You should have done this. You should have done that. You're going to get a lot more praise than you should get if you have success. And you're going to get a ton more criticism than you should get, you know, even when it's not your fault. But he said it's part of the position. And when Jake talks to young quarterbacks, it's one of the first things he brings up to them about, hey, you better have a thick hide on you because you're going to get it. No matter how good you are, you're going to catch a lot of flack for playing that quarterback position, and he's absolutely right.
And I do know this, if you want to ensure that you get hurt, play not to get hurt. Would you not agree?
In this league, you cannot play not to get hurt.
Because you pretty much guarantee yourself getting hurt if that's the way you play.
You're going to get hurt because, yep. In essence, this is the big leagues. All this stuff about football I played when I was in high school.
Let me tell you about Livaday Middle High, Mike. Let me tell you what the days were like back there at Livaday, okay? Let me tell you about that.
And it's one of them Al Bundy poke high stuff, scored 3 touchdowns in 1 game. No, in this league, them guys, this is their profession, and they take it serious. It's the same thing about tanking, which I don't get. These are the same people that talk about lazy people in this world, and they don't do this and they don't do that. But they want teams to tank. Mm-hmm. In essence, you're telling a player, I don't want you to do too well. I want you just to kind of half-ass it when you're out on the field. Come on. You play to win the game. And this stuff about draft choice position, you worry about that after the season's over with. But when you're out on the field, you out to play. And if you want to continue living this lifestyle, which pays you a lot more than you're going to get paid in the real world, you're going to give it your best because everybody's watching now, especially a team like New Orleans or the Giants. Because if your contract's coming up, what did you do when things were bad? Everybody's pretty good when you're winning, but when you're bad, how much effort did you put into that? So, again, a lot of the same people that will come on social media, text us and all about, you know, laziness and everything else, they want their own team to tank, which is really amazing to me. And it doesn't happen in the National Football League. You tank, you're going to get hurt, and you're going to be right out of the league real fast.
And to think that when you're running for a first down, you're going to have in that moment in a quarterback's mind that you're going to be in light of everything else that's going on in his mind prior to the snap and the call and the defense and everything else, you're going to think, oh wait, it's second down, I have another chance. Let me just that's somebody's never put a helmet on. That's just crazy. That's nuts. Let me take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about. Here's where I am on this season. I'm not giving up on anything. I don't want to tank anything. I'm just looking to put the team in the best position for success in the future. That's what I'm looking for here. And in terms of evaluation, you know, you got this yesterday, this one play, and I'm looking at on my phone right now. I took a picture of it where Derek Carr gets sacked, and I don't know how both tight ends can overlook a guy that's lined up in front of him. And we'll talk about fixing things like that. We'll talk about Darren Rizzi and his explosion on the sidelines against the punter and if that means anything or not and the future of the team and all that stuff. They're not technically eliminated from the playoffs, but, you know, let's be real here. 621 traffic, WWL. 626, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Mike Dettelier. I am happy the Saints won yesterday. I love the Saints. I bleed black and gold. But that being said, to be real, just to keep it honest, they barely beat a terrible team that was playing with a third string quarterback. Darren Rizzi and the head coach interim coach addressed it after the game, saying that Alvin Kamara stepped in between him and the punter and said, "Riz, I didn't expect you'd lose your blank against the punter to kind of break it up." I get a text about that. A couple of them. One says, "I was refreshing to see accountability. That's what the man gets paid for. Hugs and kisses don't get it done in the NFL." Another text says, "That's why Rizzi ain't no head coach. He's one note. Got to have more dimension than that." When Alvin Kamara is breaking up a fight on the sideline, that to me is leadership. That's what a team captain should do, and the way he did it was very diplomatic. Thoughts on that whole scenario, Mike?
You can watch games, and you'd see it every week. Okay, just so happens. I mean, the camera catches everything today. NFL films, if you watch some of their stuff, you'll see the confrontations between players, joined with one another, coach and a player. It happens, and it's in the heat of the moment, and you lose your temper. You're human. Come on, that's all that it means. And you're getting paid a lot of money, and so he got his point of interest to the punter real quickly about what he was doing wrong. But, Tommy, man, people made a big thing. Nick Saban used to explode on the sidelines.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Every week, and they would catch him doing it. And that was a big thing. It got to the point where you understood that happens a lot. It happens every week in the NFL. The same way that Alvin would be the one to get in between them is really pretty good because, man, I could have given you a lot of picks, and I don't think it would have been Alvin Kamara.
But let me tell you something. That to me, I mean, really, really showed to me a lot about him, about his maturity, about being a captain, about being a team leader, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And I know Coach Rizzi has talked about this, and I'm not sure if it was this week or maybe a couple of weeks back. He talked about on when we were having to visit Pensacola Saints coaches show that he has a really good relationship with Alvin Kamara. Really good. And he said it's just not like player coach, that, you know, they can go and talk to each other about certain things. Mm-hmm. And I think you always need to have that in a locker room, because the locker room is really controlled by players. People have this false pretense that the locker room's controlled by the head coach and the assistant coaches. No, it's not. It's controlled by the players. And so you kind of want a little bit of a guy there that's got your back if something goes wrong or things go wrong. And for him to have that type of relationship with Alvin Kamara, he said it before, and yesterday was living proof of it.
I'm going to tell you what.
You know, Alvin came in to kind of settle, hey, calm down. We're going to be okay. You got your point across. We get it.
This is saying a lot, but at this point, I would have to say AK is my favorite Saint of all time. I would have to say that. From the way he plays after seeing it yesterday, I know he had some trouble in Las Vegas and all that, but I would have to say, all in all, work ethic, everything else, commitment, I'd have to give. Now, who's your, let me ask the audience that, 504-260-1870. At this point, who's your favorite Saint of all time? And I would say Alvin Kamara, and I know you can't put his name up on that Ring of Honor yet, but he's destined for it. 6:30 more, we come back. Traffic, news, everything now on WWL. 6:45, quarter till 7. Mike Dettillier has got a long day on Monday. He's going to be second-guessing with Bobby Hebert, Mike Dettillier, today, this evening at the Silver Slipper Casino on the beach in beautiful Bay St. Louis, Mississippi. They're going to recap the Saints-Giants game, take a look at who made the first-ever 12-team college football playoff. And then at 6:30, voice of the Saints, Mike Haas, and in the Cajun Cannon, Saints Coaches Show with Darren Rizzi and quarterbacks coach Andrew Giannakko. I hope I pronounced that right. Then 7:30, Monday Night Football, the Bengals and Joe Burrow at the Dallas Cowboys on WWL on a free Odyssey app. Mike's with us now. We appreciate the long days as always, Mike. You know, look, you can look at any football game and look at any play, and there are guys that do their jobs and guys that don't, and no play is perfect, right? But when you see something like, and I want to ask you about this specifically, and it resulted in a sack of, what do you call him, Derek Carr. When you see these two tight ends lined up, Hoker and Foster Moreau, and there's a giant right in between them, and they both look away from him, and he didn't come as a late blitz or anything. He was lined right up on a line. I don't understand how that can happen. Can you take me through this?
A rookie mistake by Hoker, okay? That was his pickup. And, you know, his deal was just, I'm going out and run the pattern.
Missed a call on a coverage or something like that? Is that what happened?
Exactly. Okay. You missed basically kind of that chip on that player that you're supposed to block. And, yeah, it does happen. You know, there's a mental part of this game that people don't get. And it's a lot more complicated than you might think. That's why, you know, when you brought up about, you know, favorite Saints player, Drew Brees comes to mind immediately for me. Not only did he take this team to heights that had never been done before, but it was his work ethic and his commitment and how he would simulate plays on a Saturday by himself, mm-hmm. out on the field, and how much time and effort went into all that. That, man, that takes a lot of commitment from somebody to kind of put aside everything, and you're so focused. So that's why Drew would be, you know, he'd be on the top for me. But a lot of times with young players, and even with older players, it'll happen from time to time, a young player will miss an assignment. He misses where he should be blocking instead of going out for a pass. But his focus is, I'm going to get open. You look at Hoker's history, he's always been sort of used, if it was BYU and in Colorado State, as a pass-catching tight end. Well, guess what? In the NFL, they want you to block every once in a while. So he missed that assignment. He did get to catch his first pass ever in the NFL yesterday, but you can understand why he missed that key in picking up the guy that he was supposed to block on that play and just went out for a pass.
And again, that's just an example. You can look at tape, they got, or whatever they call it, video, and they got, you know, everybody misses a play here or there on every play. Not everybody conducts their assignment perfectly, but this is just a plain old miss. Let me ask you about what's going on in college football with the first off, let me take a step back. Let's talk about this week. No Derek Carr, so you're going to be talking about Jake Haino or Daratla. What do you think the Saints will do?
Listen, I would not count out Derek Carr not playing.
The only thing I thought of with that bad hand, it's going to be hard to get under center, right? You'd have to go in the shotgun.
Well, it's not your throwing hand.
No, I know that.
But, again, a lot of times you're coming out of the shotgun, so you can sort of be protective a little bit with it. I would not rule him out at all. People say he's not a tough guy. Come on. Be real. He's a tough guy out there. You take them shots he takes.
Oh yeah,
he's a tough guy.
And the other thing I noticed yesterday, Mike, when you give him some time, he's a different, as is every quarterback. And it probably sounds dumb. Josh Allen might be an exception, but when you give Derek Carr time, he can place the ball.
What he's really good at, Tommy, is the long pass. Mm-hmm. Man, he throws a long ball really well,
and a nice motion when he has time.
Where he struggles is in the intermediate part of the throws. That's been an issue if you go back to his high school, college, with the Raiders and with the Saints. The intermediate throws is where he struggles, really struggles. And so the deep ball he throws extremely well, but do not rule him out to play against the Commanders. And I think there'll be a lot more interest in this weekend's game than, say, the Giants.
Oh, with Jaden
Because
Daniels.
Of one guy.
Oh, yeah.
A year ago today, Jaden Daniels won the Heisman Trophy. And that guy, it was something special to watch at LSU. And look what he's done to help transform a football team in Washington that was flatlined, absolutely flatlined. He gave him some oomph, and that dude can play. That kid can play. That was his nickname, that kid. But, man, can he play.
Man, I tell you what, I happened to be on the field with Tim Zimmer for his last touchdown pass, got a great view of it, and it's amazing for people that don't get that opportunity because you're looking at the receiver and it's like, there's no way he's going to fit the ball. Oh, there he is. There, what do you know? There it is right there in that 2-inch spot. There's the ball. 6:51, 9 till 7, traffic now, more with Mike. We come back. All right, 6:57, 3 till 7. Quickly back to Mike Dettelier. Mike, let's talk about the transfer portal. Tulane, Darian Mensah, LSU, and compare the two programs and transfer portal and name, image, and likeness. And just as two case studies, how this whole new college football system is likely to affect either one.
Yeah, it's going to affect you year to year. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just the way it's set up to do. Yesterday, you got the yin and the yang with Tulane. Okay, basically looks as though, even though it's not confirmed, looks as though for sure that John Summerall is going to be back next year. Mm-hmm. And then on the other part, Darian Mensah decides he's going to put his name in the portal. He's got two lawyers that are handling all this. And so he's going to get paid a bundle by someone. And okay, they can reach out. They know who his attorneys are. Hey, this is what we're looking at. If they pay $2 million to Bryce Underwood, who's never taken a snap in a college game, Mensah's going to get a lot of dough. And so that's just part of the world that we live in today.
Mike, let me ask you this real quick.
Seven or eight.
I want to get your take on this real quick. Wouldn't it make sense? Okay, name, image, and likeness, all that stuff. All right, fine. But you know what? When you sign a deal, for 4 years, and you can't enter the transfer portal once you take some kind of name, image, and likeness money. You think you'll ever see that? Because that, to me, is the only rational bit of sense here. Because otherwise, Mensah could get his name, image, and likeness money for a year, then decide, you know what, let's go get some more name, image, and likeness money from the next highest bidder the next year, right?
That's absolutely correct. But basically, what a lot of people don't gather is these scholarships they sign, they're one-year deals. It's not a four-year scholarship.
So it works both ways.
And so now we've moved into that part of it today where you're going to see guys cash in multiple times on these name, image, likeness deals. And it's almost like free agency in the NFL, but it's going to be done at the collegiate level.
Even worse because there's no salary cap, right?
Correct. And so if you got a guy that knows how to write a big check, he can sort of buy his own team.
Best team money can buy. Thank you, Mike. We'll listen for you this afternoon.
You,
you bet. Mike Dottiglia, I always appreciate it. WWL NFL analyst, co-host of Sports Talk. He'll be second-guessing with Bobby Hebert, Silver Slipper, on the beach in Bay St. Louis, Mississippi. Head out there if you can. Have some fun with him. If not, just listen on WWL. We'll talk about Syria and Assad when we come back. Tommy Tucker, glad you're with us Monday morning, WWL. All right, 7:14 and a half, blue-gray skies get us started this week, and that is in advance of some rain that's going to happen today and tomorrow. Some rain falling already. That's in advance of a cold front. Highs today and tomorrow are around 67, and Wednesday the highs go back down to 55 degrees or so, maybe a little bit higher than that, so we'll get some more cold weather coming in. Bruce Jennelson joins us, professor of public policy and political science at Duke University, previously worked in the State Department, and on the Middle East peace process. Jordan Fiegel's smart enough to see this coming with Bashar Assad last week, and book Bruce, which is heads up to Jordan. How you doing, Bruce?
I'm good, Tommy. Hope you are as well.
I am okay. Tell people, if we can, I guess, about Syria and its place in the world and how it fell under the rule of the Assads.
Yeah, so Bashar Assad and his father, Hafez, ruled Syria for over 50 years. And even by, let's call it, standards of other Middle East countries, they were pretty brutal dictators. The Syrian political, the prisons were full of political prisoners. In the civil war that's gone on for about the last 14 years, about half the Syrian population has either fled the country as refugees or been displaced. But it seemed like, you know, there was a stalemate there. There wasn't a lot happening. And then within a week to 10 days, boom, you know, this rebel group, not the only rebel group fighting. First, it took over the city of Aleppo, which is the second biggest city up on the coast, and then was in Damascus, and now we turn around and Bashar Assad's taking asylum in Moscow.
How did it happen so quickly in a second? But first of all, how did the people of Syria, you know, I saw a quote over the weekend that I loved, and somebody said, dictators look good until the last 10 minutes. And I saw somebody else wrote a piece about institutions and individuals. And I just wonder, how did the people of Syria fall under the dictatorship of the Assads?
Well, you know, if we go back to when his father came to power in the early 1970s, you know, almost every country in the region, Arab country, was under some form of one-person rule. You know, there were kings like in Jordan. There was, you know, Saddam Hussein actually had a predecessor in Iraq. You know, in Egypt, the military, Mubarak had been in general before he came in. So it wasn't that uncommon in the region. And it got worse, you know, when the so-called Arab Spring happened in late 2010, 2011, and there were, you know, revolutions in Tunisia and Egypt and Yemen and Syria. It was another one of those moments that said, wow, you know, there'd been no change, and suddenly it's happening all over the place. And that's when Syria's civil war started. And you know, when it happened, in Tunisia and Egypt, they basically, protesters were, wanted to get rid of the leaders, you know, kind of, you know, figuratively off with your head. In Syria, it was actually interesting. They really didn't want to necessarily get rid of Assad, but they wanted him to change. And his unwillingness to reform even a little bit, you know, led to this war, you know, and there are so many different ethnic groups in Syria that this group that's triumphed is by no means the only one that's been out there fighting.
Let me ask about the ethnicity and also religion. Where does all of that fit in the makeup of Syria, and who could wind up running the country?
So this group that came to power, which the acronym is HTS, it's an Arabic name, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, is actually originally an offshoot of al-Qaeda and then ISIS. And allegedly the leader, this guy Abu Muhammad al-Jolani, says he's been more pragmatic. But he's an Islamist. He had his first major speech over the weekend at the Umayyad Mosque in Damascus, which is the biggest and a very historic mosque, and he referred to an Islamist future. So we don't know. I think it's pretty wide feeling that it's good that Assad is gone. Mm-hmm. But these guys ain't Democrats, and it's with all the four or five or more groups fighting, it's not clear how they're actually going to govern. After all the rejoicing and people getting into the presidential palace and all that sort of thing, you know, the next reports are going to be now what happens next.
Because I did see a report, Bruce, of and I forgot exactly how they phrased it, but they were protecting some facilities, and they said that they were protecting the institutions, and they didn't want it to fall into another dictatorship, which goes to individuals as opposed to institutions. But that being said, that institution could be ISIS or Sharia law, something along those lines, right?
Yeah, they did make one pragmatic move. They asked the prime minister to stay on and help them, you know, run things, provide services, and the like. And that's kind of learning the lesson from Iraq. When Saddam fell, there was an effort to get rid of everybody and anybody who'd been associated with him, including people that, you know, actually knew how to get things done and weren't necessarily, you know, repressive people. So that was a positive step. You know, Turkey's very involved. They've supported this guy. The U.S. has about 1,000 troops up in the northeast of Syria helping the Kurds, which is one of the big groups who are a Muslim group. They're not an Islamist group, but their identity is different than some of the other, you know, ethnic and religious groups in Syria. And so Turkey, Iran, Russia still has some naval bases there, so they still got some interest. The U.S., Jordan, Israel, you know, everybody is involved now. The Israelis have moved up a little bit into southern Syria. We had a bunch of airstrikes against ISIS forces, you know, just in the last day or two. So it's going to be swirling around us for quite a while.
Now, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back, and I'll ask you if what's in the best interest of the Syrian people is in the best interest of the rest of the world, or are those two aligned at all? Bashar Assad, I believe, is known to have killed about 300,000 plus of his own people, which pales in comparison to Stalin, which is at 12 million. But just like Saddam Hussein, he did use chemical weapons against his own people. 721 traffic now, WWL. 726 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Bruce Jenelson, our friend, professor of public policy, political science at Duke University, who previously worked in the State Department and on the Middle East peace process. So he knows the players. He knows of what he speaks. When it comes to Assad and Syria, I mentioned, Bruce, before the break, if what was in the best interest of Syrians was in the best interest of the rest of the world. But I wonder if you can put all Syrians in the same circle. Was Assad any nicer to Christians than he was to Muslims or sects of Muslims? Oh, Bruce, you're breaking up, and I have to have the answer to this question. Let's try it again. Bruce, let me take a break. Tim's going to try to reconnect with you. We'll try to call him back. Meanwhile, I will remind you of some things going on here at WWL. Christmas is for kids, of course, and if you want to feel good about New Orleans, you can join Newell Norman Thursday live from the New Orleans Chamber's annual business luncheon at the Hilton, New Orleans Hilton Riverside. You can visit with business and industry leaders, celebrate 20 years of the Chamber and 20 years of good business with special guests Jay Cicero, Sandra Herman, Blaine Kern Jr., and Percy Master P. Miller. That's Newell at the New Orleans Chamber's annual meeting Thursday. But Christmas is for kids. That has to do with Newell Norman Wednesday at H2O Salon and Spa on Metairie Road. He'll collect new gifts, toys and books, plus donations for Toys for Tops. You can stop by, say hi, bring an unwrapped gift, or make a donation on behalf of your family or business. Let's fill up the sidewalk with toys and gifts. Newell at H2O Salon and H2O Salon and Spa. That's Wednesday, and then he's at the Chamber luncheon on Thursday. Bruce Denelson's back, hopefully a better connection. Bruce, I asked about what's in the interest of Syrians and the interest of the country, and can you put all Syrians in the same bunch, or was Assad more friendly to Christians or Muslims of one sect or the other? Thoughts?
Yeah, there's a segment called the Alawites, which are an offshoot of Shia that was his, and he was mostly favorable to them. I think what all Syrians would benefit from is, you know, a government that's maybe a little bit democratic and is not repressive. There's a lot of natural talent in that country. I was actually there back in 2009. for some just, you know, negotiations, and I met with artists and people in business. And if some of the people, the, you know, the millions that left would come back, they could actually have a chance to set a model for other Arab countries. I wish I could be more confident that's going to happen, but that would be the best thing.
So who is it up to right now to determine what happens in Syria?
It's really going to be internal. You know, it's not something that we can determine. Right now, our highest priority is protecting the Kurds up in the northeast, because they've been fighting this group that came to power, and the Turks also don't like the Kurds because they're connected to Kurds in Turkey that the government doesn't like and all that sort of thing. And we have about 1,000 Americans stationed there. And I know I've met a lot of these guys when I come back to the States, and they believe the Kurds are really good partners. They help us fight terrorism. That's our number one priority. And then we need to work with others. Arab countries need to be in the lead in figuring out how Syria can sort of stay within the guardrails and have a prospect of a decent future. But that's not for us to go and run. We can help, but it's really time for countries like the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt to kind of be in the lead on that, because they've got the most at stake and they know the players the most. And we can help them, but we shouldn't, like, pick a side and say that's our guy. That never works.
Well, we only have 20 seconds left. Is the world a more dangerous place, less dangerous place, or no change now that Assad has left?
I think it's no change. It's like, you know, we had a terrible guy, we might have another bad guy. But, again, the fact that he left is a good thing in and of itself. So let's see where we go.
Thank you, Bruce. Appreciate it. As always, we'll come back to take a look at the Wall Street Monday Morning Markets with Mark when we return here on WWL. 7:45, quarter till 8, Monday morning, December 9th. Going to be a rainy day, and tomorrow's going to be a rainy day. And I've heard not heard anything about neutral ground parking, but I'm sure they'll send out a text when they decide to allow that. Then it turns cool on Wednesday. Mark Rosa joins us now, our friend, president, CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. Take a look at the week ahead on Wall Street, a little thing we call Monday Morning Markets with Mark. How you doing, Mark?
Good morning, sir. I'm good. How are you?
I'm okay. How's the market?
Marquette's plural. That's right. I was looking back at my notes. I said recently they all three of the indices hit highs, and you and I were talking about that just this past Monday. The Dow, S&P, and the Nasdaq hit highs. It was a combination of an expectation of the Fed acting and lowering the rates, and corporate earnings were still coming in pretty decently, and the vast majority of the companies reporting were beating their estimates. So two things determine stock prices largely. It's corporate earnings and interest rates. If you've got interest rates going down, that's the direction that you'd want. And corporate earnings going up, again, the direction that somebody would, an investor would want for sure. And that propelled all those averages to the to all-time highs. Now, the market is one of those places that's like, well, that was good. What have you done for me lately? Just 4 days later, the Dow retreated a little bit. All the analysts are worried about what the CPI and the PPI inflation gauge is going to do this week. And but before that, just what happened last week, the manufacturing rose fairly significantly. The Manufacturing Purchases Manager Index and the Institute for Supply Management. I know those are mouthfuls, but manufacturing got so beaten down over the past couple of years that that's good that it's reviving naturally. It's good for the U.S. economy, good for the people that work there, good for us, and we're buying goods and services from them. So that was good news early on.
And what and sector the, is that, Mark? What are they manufacturing?
All manufacturing. That was a manufacturing report, Tommy. So, again, that's good news. And, you know, Trump's promises are, and I think part of a more complicated issue, that he likes tariffs, and everybody knows that, but it's kind of a protectionist measure, and that could be very contentious in the economic community to say you're doing that, to imposing tariffs. But it's all kind of protectionist. It's all kind of, well, I'm trying to insulate or protect the local industries by raising prices on goods and services that are coming from abroad. So maybe that's why a lot of these averages are perking up, because he knows what, you know, maybe what economic policies are going to come out in their favor. And the so to segue into the employment report for November, that's the always reported the first Friday into the new month. So this was last Friday. where 214,000 jobs were new jobs were expected in November. Instead, it came in at 227. So that was good news also. That's what contributed to those market averages hitting highs. But the employment picture was, you know, people got to look back over 2 months. October was just crushed. It was crushed by circumstances happening at Boeing. I think they had a layoff, and we hit some hurricane activity that only produced 36,000 jobs. So if you add in the 36 to the 227, and a lot of analysts were taking the average, the number wasn't so spiffy. It was, you know, 160,000 per month over the last 2 months. So it wasn't such the surprise when the unemployment rate ticked up a little bit. We just didn't produce enough jobs to keep it at 4.1. Unemployment rate now at 4.2. Still a good number, a low number, and that's good for the economy going forward. Tommy, just a couple of weeks ago, the Fed said that the second quarter credit card numbers again hit all-time highs. And the second quarter ends on June 30th, and the consumer credit statistic came out for October, and it was expected that consumer credit would rise at $10 billion, and it rose at $19 billion, almost double what was expected. And it was like credit cards are driving purchases. It's up 14% in 8 months, and you and I had said that how high can it go, and that's a little bit of headwind on the economy because at some point that party is going to peter itself out, and then people are left with very high and very expensive from an interest rate standpoint, credit card bills. So we'll, you know, keeping an eye on that every month, of course. So segueing over to this week, we've got productivity supposed to be up. These are expectations. And then the CPI and the PPI, Consumer Price Index. This has got some of the – that's why the Dow retreated. It's got some of the market participants worried because CPI is expected to come in at up 0.3% this month. We take those figures, we multiply them by 12 and get an annual number. So up 0.3 is a 3.6% annual rate. And that's not comfortable because the last several months it was up 0.2, about a 2.4% annual rate. So if it starts to move into the 3 category, that's when the analysts are saying, well, what is the Fed going to do? And are they going to stop for a while to see what's going on? And we had all these rate cuts that were baked into the cake for this year, and the number of them came substantially lower than what was initially expected. So all this inflation news is still very much front and center. The CPI, they give you another, for instance, the year over year has been at 3.3%. It's been that way for 4 months in a row. And the Fed has said it so repeatedly. It's like, no, we want the number to start with a 2. And we want it to maintain starting with a 2, like 2.4, 2.5, 2.6. We want that going forward so we know that inflation is not rearing its head again. So that's going to be something to continue to watch, and that's where I think the market has just traded a bit sideways. And I think it's going to continue this week where it's just the CPI, as long as they come in reasonably well, the last thing would be that the Fed meets in 8 days, and the percentage probability is up over 10, 74% chance was Monday that they're going to cut rates. And now it's 85% chance they're going to cut rates by 25 basis points. So that's kind of baked into the cake. That's baked into the market average. That's baked into everybody's expectation. So they really need to hit the nail on the head. What's also rising is a percentage chance that they're not going to do anything in January. And for months, it was, no, we're going to start cutting into the first quarter of next year. So it's a lot of wait and see. A lot of this has already been planned into the numbers, Tommy. So we just got a couple of weeks left in 2024. Then you start off in January that a whole new set of earnings are going to come out. You're in earnings season again. So I think in between that, there's not a lot to motivate the market to go much higher or lower. I think it's going to hold what it has.
So, Mark, this is in a way unrelated, but my 401k used to have a thing where I could punch it in over the weekend, punch in the numbers and the security code and all that stuff and get my balance. And as of the last couple of weeks, I can't get that. They tell me to talk to an operator. Should I infer from that somebody has loaded their car with my 401k and headed to Mexico or not?
Yeah, I don't know how to interpret that. You should be able to get to your account whenever you want to.
That's what I was wondering about. I'm just saying.
Trunk load of accounts going to south of the border.
Yeah, it's a big firm. It's a big firm, so I think they're okay. Yeah. I'm just wondering about that.
I would have that same reaction, and I would get on the phone with them, and why can't I get into the account? I need to be able to check it 24/7 whenever you want to check it, not when they want to make it available. We passed, this is 1970.
Yeah.
You should be able to get in there and see what your balances are.
I'm afraid we get a guy that picks up the phone and says it's gone. It's all gone. Well, what do you mean it's gone? Well, it's gone. There's nothing we can do about it.
No. That I wouldn't worry about. But, you know, the averages have done really well this year, so people should feel good about where the balances are, depending on what you're invested in, naturally. But as far as the market averages, I think this year has been a good one.
I feel good if I could find out what the balance is. You know, as soon as
I
know
would,
that, yeah,
work on that. Look, hand the rest of the show over to Tim, and I'd get on that right away.
I'll do that. You know, God forbid.
Yes,
what do you mean? We had a problem. We had a problem, and it's gone, and there's nothing we can do about it. Thank you, Mark.
Yes, sir. Appreciate it.
We'll talk to you again. Have a great week, Mark Rosa, President, CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. 7:55, 5 till 8. Traffic now. WWL. It is 8:15, rainy day today and tomorrow in advance of a cold front. And Ghassan Corban joins us right now. As a matter of fact, Executive Director of the New Orleans Sewerage and Water Board. Good morning, Ghassan. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm okay, sir. Happy holidays, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, all that stuff if we don't talk again.
Thank you. Same to you.
Let's start with the rain and canals and pumping stations and all that stuff for the rain that's forecast today. Any concerns on your desk, Ghassan? Although every time it rains, I guess. If I were you, I'd be concerned.
Well, concerned and cautiously optimistic. Obviously, we're doing everything we can to be ready, and we feel very ready for tomorrow and Tuesday. We have 91 pumps out of the 97, so that's a good place to be. And then we have ample power to drive all the pumps that we need during the event. So we're good. We're feeling good about it.
What about catch basin cleanings and all that stuff? DPW is still doing that, right, or not?
Absolutely. For a couple more weeks, that continues to be their responsibility. They just finished a contract that involved cleaning about roughly 6,000 to 7,000 catch basins that had been, issues for them or problematic. And we're hoping to take over January 1st. We're still dealing with the amount of funding that we're going to receive from the city, which will obviously determine the level of service that we can deliver for the city.
And to be clear, I didn't mean to be disrespectful at all about you're always worried. What I mean by that is you got an antiquated system that's kind of held together with bubble gum and string. Is that accurate, pretty much?
Oh, yeah. No, I didn't take it as offensive at all. It's a fact of life. You know, we do have a fragile system. We're the first one to admit it. Very fragile. But it's good to have. We have two turbines, yes, they are old, but they have been operating fairly well. We have 5 EMDs online. We have a handful of frequency changers that give us about 10 plus megawatts. So in combination, we have more than what we need. So we have the redundancy, which is always key, given the fact that, we have a high chance of something breaking down during an event. So, I'm always cautious about over-committing and over-promising. Obviously, until such time, we have the power complex fully commissioned, which is imminently around the corner. It's in 2025. We can't wait till, we put these turbines to rest and start using one primary source of power to drive all the pumps that we need.
So Ben Myers with NOLA.com wrote a story, New Orleans citywide boil waters have eased dramatically. Here's why. If there was anything to put the gree-gree on you and have a boil water come out from New Orleans East, that was it, right, Ghassan?
That's correct. I mean, we are going to continue to have these very small localized boil water advisories throughout the city. And it's just a fact of life, and it's a fact of life in every city. As a matter of fact, D.C. just lifted the boil water advisory just yesterday. They had it for about 3 days. So all cities have to I don't know what the word, maybe struggle or face these situations, because water mains do break and pressure is lost. The system is compromised. And as a, you know, again, a step, cautionary step, you just, you know, make sure that the water is safe before you consume it. And we will always have those here and there. But the fact that we haven't had a citywide boil water advisory, except for the recent one earlier this year, due to unfortunate events, you know, I think we're doing very well in terms of how the city is performing because of the investment we've made with the towers, with newer pumps, and just a more resilient system that is serving the city much, much better, especially with when it comes to high events, whether it's the Super Bowl, whether it's Taylor Swift, whether it's the 17 million visitors that come to our city, the likelihood of them facing that boil water advisory has diminished significantly.
These twin towers, I think we need to get those decorated, and I think we need to make them an iconic part of New Orleans, because I do like the way they look, and I like what it symbolizes, you know what I mean, in terms of advancement and improvements. Do they have anything to do with what happened in New Orleans East with that boil water advisory? I guess it was New Orleans East and maybe Gentilly. I get my neighborhoods confused.
Yeah, and you know, there's two reasons why you would have a boil water advisory. If either you lose the power at the source, where that's where the towers play a huge role, a direct role in avoiding the boil water advisory, because then they maintain supply and pressure if we lose power. So that if the pumps are not working, pumping water into the transmission lines to deliver water to the distribution lines, then those towers play a huge role in filling those transmission lines with water and pressure. But if you have at the extremities of the system where you have a hydrant that's hit or a water main that breaks, in that very instance, you will have a drop in pressure in that area itself. And no matter how much pressure we have at the plant, you will always have that drop in pressure. And until you isolate the main and you repair it, you are basically under boil water advisory. And typically we've had those last for 24 hours, and we lift them off. So.
And those two towers are for everything on the East Bank, Hassan? Is that accurate?
They serve the entire city. But again, you know, the distinction is what the cause is,
right,
in the drop of pressure.
No, but I'm just wondering, West Bank too, you know, those towers affect the West Bank too?
No, it's strictly East Bank. The West Bank has its own water purification plant and storage tanks and pumping ability. So those are standalone. And we've had, you know, here and there, just again, localized situations, but nothing major.
Is that the tank right off of Patterson, if I'm remembering correctly, or not?
I believe so. There's a couple of them.
All right.
Yeah.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up here. We'll come back. Talking to our friend Hassan Qurban, Executive Director, New Orleans Surge and Water Board. 822 Traffic Now, WWL. Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Hassan Qurban, Executive Director of the New Orleans Sewage and Water Board. Hassan, what's going on with the meters? And somebody texted in, and I hate to take individual calls because, you know, everybody's occasionally has problems, and I'd like to deal with the bigger picture. But in case it's representative of a group of people, they got a leaking new smart meter, and they've called and they're not getting any response. What do people do if they got a water meter problem? You there, Hassan? You got me muted? Hassan Qurban, you got me muted, perhaps? Hit that mute button, and then we can hear you. Hassan Qurban, Executive Director of the New Orleans Sewage and Water Board, waiting for him to unmute himself. And at that point, we'll get to the question. We're talking about boil water advisories, how they've gone down, and how they're ready for the rain that's going to come today. They got 91 out of 97 pumps working, which is a good position to be in, he said, and ample power. So Tim is in the process of reconnecting there. I will remind you this evening, you can second guess with Bobby Hebert, Mike Dettelier at the Silver Slipper Casino on the beach in beautiful Bay St. Louis, Mississippi. Man, I've been longing to take a ride out to Mississippi. We can recap the Saints and Giants game, take a look at who made the first ever 12-team college football playoff, And who do you have winning it all? Lynn at 6:30, voice of the Saints, Mike Haas, who my favorite part of his call yesterday was when he passionately called for the Giants to put in a player from James Madison University. Anyway, Mike Haas joins the Cajun Cannon. Saints coaches show Darren Rizzi, quarterbacks coach Andrew Janocco. Then at 7:30, Monday Night Football, the Bengals and Joe Burrow at the Dallas Cowboys. That's on WWL and the free Odyssey app. Apparently, Ghassan Corban had some phone problems, but we were in the midst of talking about the towers and how they're going to prevent future boil water advisories. And somebody had texted in about a problem with the smart meter leaking and how you get that all fixed up and so forth. But Ghassan is back. Okay, Ghassan, we only have a minute left. Sorry about the technical issues we had there. If somebody's got problems with a leaky meter, what do they do?
If you have a leaky meter, you call 52 Water, and we will obviously address it as soon as we can. It's obviously imperative to recognize where the leak is. If it's on the inflow on our side, obviously it still needs to be repaired, but it really will not impact the actual volume of water that's going through the meter, so it's not registered. If the leak is on the side of the property, it could still be our responsibility to repair, but it would be then registering, causing the consumption number to appear higher than your typical consumption. That's when people get obviously upset or nervous, and that's where those are the ones we address earlier than the other ones, just because it impacts the amount of consumption being registered.
And look, we are running late. So, we only have a minute left, and I want to jump to this news. We're going to be a minute late.
Yeah.
But real quick, give me an overview of the smart meter program. How's it working, generally speaking?
We are on track. We hit a milestone, an exciting milestone of 70,000 smart meters in the ground. That's an awesome accomplishment for, you know, starting in spring of this year with the plan to finish the rest of them by before end of next year. So it's a very, very exciting place to be producing smart bills for 70,000 of our customers. It's just long-awaited place to be, and we're here, and we're very excited.
Thank you, Ghassan. Appreciate your time. We'll talk to Jeff Palermo when we come back quickly to WWL First News. 847, 13 till 9, Jeff Palermo joins us, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network News Director. Got a story up at WWL.com. College football transfer portal opens, and LSU's expected to be aggressive. Hey, Jeff, how you?
I'm doing well, Tommy. How about yourself?
I'm all right. That big old door is opened, huh?
Yeah, it opened. So now hundreds, Tommy. I mean, literally hundreds of players are diving into that transfer portal and hoping that it's, you know, the pasture's greener on the other side, right? I mean, that's kind of what they're hoping for, a better opportunity somewhere else. And the unfortunate part about this, for a lot of kids, they're not going to probably find a spot that might be better for them. A lot of kids get kind of lost and swallowed up by the transfer portal, but there still will be some quality players in there, and LSU said that they'll be aggressive, so we'll see how aggressive they'll be.
So let's talk about who they lost first, as far as
yeah.
we know.
Well, I would say probably the biggest ones at this point are, I think C.J. Daniels is the biggest surprise. He is set to enter the transfer portal. This was a guy that Brian Kelly was talking about, how they anticipate that he'll be back next season, and he was such a key part of this offense, truly a really good possession receiver, a guy that can move the chains for you. And, you know, it really, when you have the head coach talking about how they're looking forward to having him back, I mean, the thing was you were wondering if he was going to get into the NFL draft, and because he's been in college football since 2000. He gets the free COVID year, and then he also had a season where he was injured early on in the year, so he got a medical redshirt. So you didn't think he was coming back.
He's been in college football
season.
Since when?
2000. Yeah, so he's going to be a six-year player next year, and so the feeling was is that he may be considering going into the NFL, but no, he apparently wants to go to a different school. Shelton Sampson, a big-time wide receiver out of Catholic High of Baton Rouge, who did not catch a pass in his two seasons at LSU. He's headed to the transfer portal. That's a loss. I think one of the disappointing storylines to this season when LSU had some injuries at the wide receiver position, namely Chris Hilton. Shelton Sampson couldn't step up and be that guy. That was a disappointing development that occurred during the season, and now he'll look to go play somewhere else. Kylan Jackson, another area kid from Zachary at the safety position. I mean, LSU struggled at the safety position this year, and he was someone that could not interject himself in there. He had some opportunities early on in the season to be a significant part of this LSU defense. It did not transpire for him, and now he's headed to the transfer portal along with Jordan Allen. And then, you know, there's some other guys out there as well. Freshman linebacker Xavier Atkins, Jair Brown, a cornerback from Ohio State who never really saw the field or didn't see the field that much other than early this season. And then Bernard Causey, a freshman cornerback, a three-star recruit that just never really made a difference. So, you know, those are the guys that are in there at the moment, the big ones anyways.
So what about on the defensive side? You lost some defensive backs?
Well, yeah, as I mentioned, Jordan Allen and Zy Alexander at the safety position. So that makes – and I think LSU would have been looking to try to get someone – at safety, too. I mean, Major Burns has exhausted his eligibility. Sage Ryan, there's a possibility that he could enter the NFL draft. He participated in senior night as a redshirt junior. And then Jarden Gilbert, who it wasn't a great season for him. So LSU certainly needed to upgrade the safety position. They got some young guys ready to go there in Deshaun Spears out of Denham Springs, and then Joel Rogers out of West Feliciana High School. But you're going to need to find somebody there at that safety position, because that was one area that they really struggled in this past season.
I was distracted a little bit because I was watching the video of Brian Kelly dancing with Danny Lewis, who eventually went to Alabama, but now he's hitting the portal. LSU's losing Mason Taylor. Are they going to pursue him or not? And is Brian Kelly going to dance
with
him?
Yeah, I mean, a tight end is, I think, a huge need on this team, along with wide receiver. I mean, the two tight ends that you have on your roster, Kamorian Pimpton and Tre'Dez Green, are more known for their pass-catching abilities than their blocking abilities. So they're going to need, somebody there at that tight end position. Now, they've offered Northwest Missouri State transfer Zach Atkins. But I don't know if that one, we'll see if they go and get him. But there's been, I would think at the tight end position, LSU should be able to find someone that's pretty good, because Brian Kelly has a history with his offenses of really using the tight end position. Brian Kelly's got a keen eye for finding good tight ends. And let's face it, you know, Mason Taylor had three really good seasons here at LSU. He was not as prominent last year as he was, obviously, this year. He was a big-time playmaker for LSU offensively. So for a tight end that's looking for a chance to showcase his skills, you would think LSU would be a good landing spot for that person.
Jeff, I'm trying not to hurt myself, Venn diagrams on this piece of paper with transfer portal with name, image, and likeness on it, right? So
yeah.
Or is it like an eclipse? Is one completely on top of the other? Is it three quarters name, image, and likeness, and a quarter transfer portal that does excludes name, image, and likeness? You understand where I'm going with this, right?
Well, I mean, with this transfer portal situation, I mean, a lot of the players that are in there are looking not only for playing times, but they're looking for NIL dollars as well. And the fact that LSU missed out on a couple of five-star recruits out of high school that were supposed to be part of this 2025 team, that has freed up some money here for LSU to spend these NIL dollars elsewhere. When they lost Bryce Underwood and Kate Phillips to other schools, that frees it up. I mean, I think that's a reason why, when you go back to it, when Brian Kelly was asked about the transfer portal before Bryce Underwood decommitted and decided to go to Michigan, Coach Brian Kelly said, yeah, the transfer portal will be something we'll certainly look at. We'll try to supplement the roster through it. But then after they lost Bryce Underwood, he changed his tune on it. He said, no, we're going to be very aggressive in it. And it's because they now have more dollars freed up. And then Mason Taylor deciding to go to the NFL. I mean, there was a push by LSU to see if they can get Taylor to come back for his senior season. He has decided to go to the NFL draft. And so that frees up some money. And then Will Campbell, who was technically your highest paid NIL earner on this football team, he's headed to the NFL draft. So LSU has NIL dollars available, and it's now up to them to go out there and get them. But there are other schools that are have a lot of cash too when it comes to NIL. So LSU has to beat them out for it, and we'll see what happens here over the next several weeks.
One quick question, I'll let it go at this: is it all about the money now?
A lot of it is all about the money. I mean, a lot of it is. There's still those players that also value fit and the coaching staff and the school and all that kind of stuff. But for a lot of these guys, it's all about the money. And you kind of wonder, when it's all about the money, how good of a player will they really be if all they're worried about is money? That's got to also be a big concern for these coaches that are going after these players.
And they can game the system. They can keep transferring every year and signing new name, image, and likeness deals, and they better get a handle on that quickly. It's going to be even a bigger mess. Thank you, Jeff.
All right, sounds good. Thanks.
All right, go to WWL.com. You can see Jeff's article, 856, 4 till 9. Traffic now, WWL. And we are breezing through a Monday morning, December 9th. The text comes across from Nola Reddy. Heavy rain could cause street flooding, neutral ground parking allowed through 8 a.m. December 10th, which would be tomorrow. Be careful of debris on neutral ground, etc. So, neutral ground parking approved through 8 a.m. tomorrow with the usual considerations of don't block intersections, street car tracks, and all that kind of stuff. We're going to talk about electric vehicles this hour. Steven Melnick's our friend, our guest, professor of supply chain management at Michigan State, where he's done research in the strategic supply chain, cybersecurity, performance measurements, and supply chain design. He is our EV go-to guy. Good morning, professor. How are you?
Good morning. Very well. Thank you. And yourself?
Well, fine. Thank you for taking the time with us. What's it like in Michigan? I'm just curious today.
It has been, there's an old saying in Michigan that says, if you don't like the weather, wait 5 minutes and it'll change. About 3 or 4 days ago, we had snow that required me to bring out my snowblower. Mm. And on Sunday, most of that disappeared and we were in the 60s.
No kidding.
So
really?
It's been interesting. It's been up and down.
Wow. And what about today?
Today's going to be a nice day. It's going to be on the cool side, but it's going to be a busy day for me. So I think it should be in around the 40s. It's basically, we're getting into winter.
Yeah, I just picture Michigan being, it's all like always like the Ohio State game, right? You always picture cold, gray Ann Arbor skies, but not always. Let's talk about EVs.
We don't talk about Ann Arbor, but that's the evil empire to anyone from Michigan State.
Okay, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have brought it up. Let's talk about, I'm looking at a Yahoo argument, a Yahoo story here, yahoo.com. A representative from Ohio saying that Pete Buttigieg will leave his transportation secretary job, having spent $7.5 billion to build 8 EV charging stations. And then Donald Trump Jr. sharing the post, adding, doesn't seem like a great return on investment. But the politics of this is interesting because Elon Musk, who builds Teslas, is a big Donald Trump supporter. So I guess you got the politics of this, you got the economics of this, you got the science of this. For people that don't know about EVs, let's take a step back, Professor, and explain, before you go shopping for an electric vehicle, some of the things you need to be aware of.
Okay, first of all, EVs are a very different technology in contrast to the internal combustion or ICE vehicle. What you've got is you've got typically 4 motors, each one driving a wheel. They are heavier with the current technology, they're heavier than a comparable internal combustion car. That's because of the battery pack. You also have a battery pack, which is itself in many cars the biggest limitation. It gives you your range. It's affected by factors such as the cold. I was talking to my next door neighbor who works for the Michigan Department of Natural Resources, and he has an EV truck that he uses as his business. And he was up in Ludington, and he made the observation that it went to around freezing, and suddenly he lost about 30% of his power. That is to say, if your range was, let's say, 400 miles, multiply that by 0.7, and that gives you your effective range. And if you add in factors such as, you know, putting on the heater, et cetera, it basically means that you're dealing with around 250 to 280 miles range. And on top of that, you've got to deal with the fact that when you go out and charge your vehicle, charging becomes an issue. And you've got two issues there. You've got, have you got access to the right charging port? And can you get access to a fast charger? And is there availability of chargers? And that was really, when the Trump administration was talking about the costs, what they were really getting to is the fact that the Department of Transportation, which is going to be currently, according to my information, Sean Duffy looks like he's going to be the nominee for the to head up the Department of Transportation. They had money which they were investing in terms of basically, as pointed out, $7.5 billion program to develop an EV charging infrastructure. And that's not just simply charging stations, that's having the system in place, availability, et cetera. There's also, if you look at what's happening, there's also money that's been invested or available for investing. For example, the Department of Energy has money that they're going to be used, that they could use for loan guarantees to battery makers and materials miners. They have a $2 billion program to convert old factories to EVs. They also have $6 billion in grant for companies that build battery components and recycle end-of-life batteries, which is a major issue. The battery itself in operation is very efficient. The problem that you have is building the battery, and then once the battery reaches its end of its life, you've got to get rid of the battery. And that's not just simply, like, take a look about the problem we've had getting rid of tires. You've got similar problems in getting rid of batteries, which means you have unique materials. You just can't simply dump them into a landfill and hope it's not going to do any damage.
So you've
got all of these. Go on.
No. I can't tell when you stop. I want to hear you. That's why you're here. Go ahead, please.
Okay. No. And so what I'm trying to say is, when you hear Trump saying this, understand that what he's talking about is really multiple issues. So what you've got is you've got industry which is looking at converting to EVs as a way of dealing with energy shortages, and on the other hand, you've got Trump talking about the fact that he wants to do things not only get rid of the charging infrastructure issue, but also get rid of the $7,500 EV tax credit, which is what Elon Musk is really excited about.
About getting rid of the tax credit? You mean sarcastic?
Yes. No, seriously.
Why?
Okay, understand what's happened. Elon Musk is the leader. Mm-hmm. Today I was kind of, as I was getting ready for this discussion, I was looking through with one of the Bloomberg Business, their online presence. They had a really interesting article about Volkswagen and their current struggles that they have in this period of time. Most traditional ICE companies, internal combustion companies like General Motors, companies like Ford, Volkswagen, BMW, Mercedes, compared to Tesla, they're behind, they're really lagging. When you build an EV, you've got several things that you have to manage. You've got to do the vehicle, the battery, and the information system. And if you look at Tesla, they're ahead of the curve there. So in essence, what's happening is the $7,500 tax credit that currently was instituted by Biden under the Inflation Recovery Act, I think that's the name of it, the Recovery Act that was designed to help the economy get back after the pandemic. What Tesla sees this as, this is hurting the competition. They're behind the gap. They're behind Tesla.
What's helping the competition and hurting them, right?
Right. It's basically hurting the competition, helping Tesla. Because before, that enabled people to consider buying cars that lowered the price of cars, for example, from GM. And now what's happening is you're taking away that. Tesla has an inherent competitive advantage.
Let me use the timeout, Professor, because I'm getting confused. So you got a $7,500 tax credit for an EV, correct?
Yep.
That applies to Teslas as well?
Yep.
Okay.
But here's the point.
Yeah.
If you take it, the competition has been using this to help increase demand for their products. Mm-hmm. Tesla has an inherent advantage, because they've been dealing with all three factors for a period of time. And so consequently, what's happening is what Tesla is seeing is what Elon Musk is seeing is that if this is taken away, it takes away a form of support for the competition.
Mm-hmm.
So given this, it's, as one person put it, I'm going to quote something which I found was interesting. There's a guy by the name of Mike Murphy, who's a longtime Republican strategist who runs the EV Politics Project. And he described Tesla's support for the removal of this tax credit as, quote, Tesla first, everyone second policy. Because if you take away the If you take away the support from the other companies, you're helping them. And Tesla has been cutting prices. It's been very aggressive in the market. It's got the advantage. You see companies like General Motors, Ford. General Motors, of all the companies I looked at, has been basically making the best progress. You've got companies like Stellantis struggling. You've got companies like Toyota struggling. Toyota doesn't know if they're going to be doing EVs or hydrogen. So what this is doing, this has been a support for them, not only for those companies, but consider something else. How about the other companies in the market? Companies like the Lucid Group, Arrival, Fisker, which is now filed for bankruptcy, Rivian Auto, Polestar Automotive, Northvolt, which is a Swedish-based battery maker. These companies have been helped by this credit because it makes their product more affordable.
So Elon Musk is saying, in essence, I don't care if people have to, in essence, pay $7,500 more for my vehicle, my product, my Tesla. They're going to buy it anyway. Do away with the tax credit, and then that'll really shut off the competition. Is that an accurate statement?
Well, it's not so much that it's going to be like, you've been helping everyone. Take it away from them. They're going to be struggling because they have to make up that cost. I'm in a better position to compete because I've already made the investments.
Even though the end result would be people are going to wind up paying $7,500 more if they buy a Tesla,
yep,
because the credit goes away, correct?
That's right. And that presents a few problems because the first thing is many of the car companies and the EVs are really not financially stable. If you look at a recent report that's been done, I'll just give you some statistics. In a recent report, they found out that of the 54 publicly traded EV and battery startups, 7 companies have already filed for bankruptcies, 13 are projected to run out of cash by summer 2025, and some 27 are losing money. Mm. So if you think of it, you take away the support of this. What this does is it reduces the price of their product.
Mm-hmm.
And now the product goes up, it becomes more expensive. Elon Musk has been basically cutting prices. He's aggressive. He's going to cut prices to put him into a difficult position. And so what's going to happen is you're going to see EV companies on the margin fall away. And I don't know what's going to happen. And on top of that, that doesn't address the challenge that we have, that China's sitting there. And China is a formidable competitor when it comes to EVs.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back, Professor. We'll digest what we heard so far. Got a lot of questions pouring in. And Boy, just a lot of questions. I guess I don't even want to pose any now because I don't want to get ahead of myself. 922, we're talking to Stephen Melnick, professor of supply chain management at Michigan State, where he's done research in strategic supply chains, cybersecurity performance, measurement, supply chain design. As Jordan said, he is our EV MVP. So, professor, basically, Elon Musk, if this $7,500 credit goes away, if I'm understanding what you just said is, he could take less profit until everybody else was out of business and he'd almost own the market himself. Accurate?
I don't know if he would own the market. I'm just going to simply say the following. It puts the other companies into a disadvantage. It disadvantages them. I'll give you one final thing before you take a break. Consider the following. Rivian and Lucid, which are two of the more stable companies, since the election of Trump, have seen their stock prices fall by about 50%.
Wow.
So think about it. You know, what you have is you have a company which is an industry leader. And he looks at this and he says, it's artificial support for everyone else. Let's go to a more even playing ground. I'm willing to take the price cuts because I've invested. What are you going to do?
Let me take a break, and I think we could come back with this question in the text line, which is a good one to put it all in context. And it says simply, did the government ever build gas stations? To go back and see what the evolution of the internal combustion engine and how we got to going with using cars in the United States and now the transfer to electric vehicles. Back in a flash, WWL. 9:30, talking to our EV MVP, Stephen Melnick, professor of supply chain management at Michigan State. Professor, a text came in, I think it's a good one, about did the government ever pay... Did they ever pay to build gas stations? I guess is what the question was saying, going to the development of the ICE and vehicles and roadways, et cetera. Go ahead.
Okay. First of all, you're right, they didn't. But you've got to take that up. Okay. Bit of a history statement. You've got to take that statement with a grain of salt because it was not until the 1930s that the government got into the business of retirement with Social Security. So that was something that was not even considered in the time period of Henry Ford. When Henry Ford was looking at the Model T car, he realized that as he was cutting the price because of his, you know, improvements in production. You know, like, for example, you can have the car in any color you want as long as it's black. That was one aspect, but had to give the people the ability to use it because he was not only in competition with other gas car builders, he was in competition with companies that were rebuilding cars driven by steam, cars driven by electricity. So he had to make his product easy, accessible to more people. So what did he do? He worked with Standard Oil, and he got Standard Oil to invest in gas stations because it was their capability. He also worked with Rand McNally. Why Rand McNally? Because prior to Rand McNally, you didn't think about traveling long distances between cities. Like, for example, me getting in the car and going to Detroit, or me getting in the car and going to Chicago, or you getting in the car and going from New Orleans to Baton Rouge. You know, you basically took the train, or else you didn't do it. And when you had roads which were unknown, you needed a method that could help people get from point A to point B. How did you do it? Rand McNally came in with the Atlas. You know, right now we have the descendants of it when you're working with your GPS app and it talks about state of construction. Now we have a situation where the government and economics has recognized that there are certain activities which are, quote, cloaked with public good. For example, military defense. And those type of goods are things that should be done by the government. And in this case, the problem that you have with the EV structure is that you need to have a structure of EV filling charging stations, which is comparable to gas charging stations, which is accessible to people. And this is accessible not simply to only Teslas, it's accessible to anyone. And that's a major undertaking. And so what's happening is people now recognize that investing in fueling infrastructure because it benefits multiple companies and multiple people, this is an appropriate area in which government gets involved. I mean, we don't, you know, we shouldn't get involved with certain areas which are better done by the private sector. But since this is something like road maintenance, I mean, can you imagine what would happen if the government didn't pay for road maintenance?
So let me ask you so this, Professor.
Sure.
Take me through an example of how the development of the EV industry would mirror that of, because you don't need navigation aids anymore. That's already there. Nope. You don't need, what was the other one you said about?
You need, okay, what you need, when I gave you the example, you asked the question, how did we develop the fillings, the, you know, service stations?
So I guess how would it organically develop without government support, or could it, the EV industry?
Yeah, well, okay, I don't know about back then with Henry Ford. It developed because Henry Ford went to the people in Standard Oil and said he needed this, and this was an opportunity for both companies. In today's environment, what you need, okay, let's go on. If we think that EVs are part of the solution, I'm of the opinion right from the get-go that we will never get to a pure 100% EV solution. I think it's going to be some form of hybrid, a mixture. In order to make EVs attractive, because right now they've hit the chasm, what you have to do is lower the price of the vehicle, increase the availability of charging stations, and reduce charging time. The challenge that you have is all three areas have got to be dealt with. You take away the $7,500 price tax credit, that's not attacking number one. Then you have the two issues. How do we then get charging stations, which are as numerous as you have gas stations? Because one of the problems people are going to have is range, you know, I forget the exact term, it's range concern. That is, they're going to worry about the fact that they will not have enough electric power to get them to the next charging station. That's going to be a major issue. Right now, the only company that I see capable of doing that is Tesla. But I don't think Tesla understands or is, how can I put it? Tesla is profit-driven. This is something which helps multiple people. I don't see them as putting the same degree of emphasis on it. To give you an example, when there was some time ago when demand dropped, Tesla got rid of his fast charging people. If Tesla thinks that this is important, he would have kept them. So what I'm concerned about is if you want EVs to be more than town cars, if you want EVs to be bought by people who view it as their single car, not as one of three cars, then you've got to deal with the issue of having range, adequate charging stations, fast charging time. Fast charging time is being looked at in technology. Having charging stations is an infrastructure issue. And I don't see anyone in the private sector doing it without having duplication, without having, you're going to have consolidation, without having, it's going to be a problem for me.
Let me take a break, Professor, and I will pick it up here when we come back. All right, Elon Musk, the $7,500 credit goes away. You want the EV market, you got it. Now what do you do with it? We'll talk about that when we come back. Stephen Melnick, our guest, professor of supply chain management at Michigan State. Unless you're just selling people modified golf carts, I don't understand. We'll talk when we come back. Right now, traffic, WWL. All right, that's enough. Let's go back to Stephen Melnick, professor of supply chain management at Michigan State. Professor, so let's talk about Elon Musk and the EV market. Okay, Elon, $7,500 credit goes away. You got it. What happens now?
Well, the problem that you have is that when that goes away, we've got the other issues. Right now, the most visible aspect is the $7,500, and that's the one thing Trump has talked about. But I want you to take a look at some of the things. First of all, you asked a question regarding what differentiated Elon Musk from his competition. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to give you something to think about. Number one, Elon Musk is a very vertically integrated company. They build their own batteries. They develop their own software. They assemble their own cars. If you look at GM and Ford, they're different. they assemble. That's their model, which means if you take the selling $500, it not only affects GM and Ford, it also affects the suppliers of batteries, which is important. Mm-hmm. It affects, to give you an example, these battery suppliers themselves are on very shaky ground. A good example, Northvolt, which is a Swedish-based battery company, just filed for bankruptcy after BMW canceled a key order.
Wait, let me jump in for 1 second. Is Elon Musk involved in battery production at all?
Yes, he is. He's a vertically integrated company.
Okay, gotcha. Go ahead.
So anyway, what's really happening is this thing is not only affecting, and then on top of that, what I'm really interested is Trump has nominated two people, Chris White and Sean Duffy. They're nominees. Chris White's going to manage. He's been proposed as the head of the Department of Energy. Sean Duffy's been proposed as the head of the Department of Transportation. Both departments are critical to EVs. And the other issue that's going to make things interesting is we've got to deal with politics. And that's something that Elon Musk, that's separate from Elon Musk. And what I mean by politics is Georgia just announced a major battery plant. If I'm Trump, I don't want to upset Georgia. They're one of my strongest supporters. And take a look at how important, you know, these two departments are to the future of EVs. Wright would oversee loan programs in the Department of Energy, $6 million in loan guarantees to battery makers, material miners. And that's something that Elon Musk is also going to be concerned about because little thing to think about. Trump has talked about putting tariffs on China, and China has responded saying, okay, fine, you won't get batteries, you won't get the minerals you need to make batteries, or that items.
So let me jump in with that for a second, because I'm getting a lot of text on that. In terms of energy dependency, how dependent is the United States going to make itself on countries like China and others for the materials needed to make batteries for the EVs as opposed to oil and the things needed to produce gasoline?
Well, here's the point. If you looked at the inducements offered by the Department of Energy, the Department of Transportation, in terms of battery, you know, loan guarantees, conversions, grants for companies that will build components, if you look at the DOT, which provides a $7.5 billion program, what you're doing is, if you take that away, we're going to turn and look at getting supplies. A lot of our materials come from China. That's the fact of the matter. So what you have to think about is, if you take away the grants, if you take them away, how are we going to build batteries? How are we going to have the materials to build batteries? We're going to have to rely on technology. But to do that, you've got to have inducements. And so this is a complex area, and then if you add in politics, several of the red states have announced battery plants. Do you want to compromise those? So what I'm saying is you've got the $7,500. Elon Musk is totally in favor of that. But then it helps him in one way. On the other hand, we've got issues involving raw materials. We need to develop a source of material that's not China dependent, and that's going to take time and money. We're going to need to have a supply chain. Elon Musk has got his own supply chain, which means we're going to be building based on what he has, which is we're limited by one company. If we want to have a broader usage of EVs, we're going to have more. We need more competition, and then that. So you've got the fact we're dependent on China. And then on the other hand, I'm going to throw you another wrench. The Chinese cars are coming into the market. Something for you to think about. Just, you know, with me, a straight line is a curve. There's a guy on the YouTube called Doug DeMuro, and he does reviews of cars. He was invited out by three Chinese companies stationed in L.A., to review their cars. One of the car companies that he was invited has a great, great name, one that everyone in your audience should recognize, Triumph. Mm-hmm. Think about the legacy of Triumph. And he drove them, and he was surprised. He said the price was significantly cheaper, they were high quality, and they drove well. that to me is the bigger issue, which is in the short term, Tesla wins. In the long term, my concern is China wants to get into our market. China sees the United States as a large market. We're having difficulty getting into the Chinese market. They want to get into our market, and they're going to do it the way they've done it in other industries. What China does is it goes from the bottom up. That is, it comes in at the bottom with the low price stuff that nobody wants to touch, and it then grabs market share. And the auto industry is letting China, in essence, preparing China to do that. There was a recent report that talked about GM. GM reported profits going up, but yet they sold fewer items. And how did they do that? They were charging more for each item. And yet there was another report that came out saying that there is an enormous pent-up demand from customers, consumers, for well-built cars between $20,000 to $25,000. And if you look at the price of the Chinese, even with the tariffs, guess what? They're in that sweet spot. So what you have going on here is my concern with the Trump initiative is it affects one thing, but it also affects a lot of other things. And ultimately, our goal is we should be to build low-cost, reliable cars which are well-supported, which can be charged, which can be driven for longer distances by American car companies.
Now, and real quick, before I let you go, I know the Biden administration put that 100% tariff, I think it was, on the Japanese,
Chinese.
If that were to go away, and I'm not saying it is, but I'm just saying hypothetically, and the Chinese were to flood the market with their $10,000 EVs, that would collapse the charging system in the country, would it not?
Yes, it would. And therefore, you have a problem. You have the fact that but then here's the situation. It's going to create, in essence, without a charging station, and if people use the charging ports in their own home, they're going to create a system where the EV becomes essentially a town car. Mm-hmm. It's a car that you use to run around town. And that's fine, but I think if we are to get the benefits, and by the way, just to let you know, since there was a report that just came out from the EPA that pointed out that, guess what? The shift of American consumers, as small as it is, to EVs, has had a significant impact on emissions. Wow. So if we're going to have that impact, it's not enough. We've got to have a three-peater. We've got to have low-priced cars, availability of low-cost charging, fast, combined with a supply chain that can support competitors in the market.
The hat
and
trick.
Competition, a hat trick. You need competition because, I hate to say this, competition drives innovation.
It does.
And when you're in the market like EVs, you need competition.
Thank you, Professor. Appreciate your time as always. Stephen Melnick, Professor of Supply Chain Management at Michigan State. You can download the Odyssey app, use the Rewind feature, or just go to WWL.com, click on my name. You'll find this audio posted soon if you want to go back and re-listen. Back in a flash, WWL.